Stay tuned for Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. And this is Mike Fader with Occupied Territory America. Don't forget, we have a Facebook page if you're on Facebook, if you can stand Facebook. But it's a constant sort of political blog and dialogue that goes on between me and you. And just to go to Occupied Territory on Facebook. Today we're going to talk about Bradley Manning's trial and about Bradley Manning and what he's being tried for and all sorts of things that flow from that and to that. Also, we're going to try perhaps to segue or relate some of this stuff to what happened with Mr. Snowden and the NSA spying on Americans. Also, perhaps overclassification of documents, various things that are all connected. We have with us Elizabeth Goitein, who is from the Brennan Center for Justice. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Okay. Elizabeth co-directs the Center's Liberty and National Security Program, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect the rule of law and constitutional values. And before coming to the Brennan Center, Ms. Goitein served as counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee on the Senate Judiciary Committee. As counsel to Senator Feingold, Ms. Goitein handled a variety of liberty and national security matters with a particular focus on government secrecy and privacy rights. And she's also worked on matters involving immigration, juvenile justice, sentencing, and First Amendment issues. So Bradley Manning is being tried as we speak. Now, he already pleaded guilty to certain charges, right?
That's right. He did.
And what were the charges that he pleaded guilty to?
Well, he pleaded guilty to a number of different charges, including technically some of the Espionage Act charges against him. But what is interesting is the way he did it. He did something called pleading by exception and substitution, which is a very unusual creature in which rather than simply plead to some of the charges that the government brought against him or some lesser included charges or something like that and get the government's approval to go forward on that, he agrees unilaterally to plead guilty to something that he basically writes. He sort of strikes out some parts of the statute and writes in some other parts and basically writes something that he thinks is closer to what he actually did. And then the government can either accept that plea or not, but once he's made the plea, he is on the record as having admitted to doing the things that he's done and can be sentenced for them. Now, it's a very strange procedure.
Well, why was it allowed in this particular case, and what does he get out of it?
Well, I think what he gets, I mean, it's up to the judge to decide whether to allow it, and it's a calculated risk that's taken by the defense. And I think part of the risk that they're taking is, first of all, they take some of the steam out of the government's case when the government, you know, doesn't have to come in and prove every single thing in a way that's going to sort of over time create this impression of, you know, of massive amounts of you know, misconduct on his part, because he's sort of taken some of those facts off the table. But I think even more than that, the idea is to show the judge, I think, because this case is being tried by a judge, that he takes some responsibility and try in that way to really sort of buy some sympathy from
the
judge.
It's mitigation. Is that the phrase for it?
Yes. I mean, it's sort of a colloquial version of mitigation. Yes.
This obviously is something that that is worked out between the prosecution and the defense, right? I mean, along obviously with Mr. Manning.
Well, that's what's different about this kind of plea deal. I mean, the in an ordinary plea deal, the defense and the prosecution, they work it out together, and they agree that both parties are okay with it, and they agree to what would be a fair sentence given what's being pled to. This is a different process. This is a process where the defense kind of makes something up, and the government might like it and they might not like it. And in this case, the government except for one of his pleas, which the government accepted. The government did not accept the others. So the government will have to go forward and prove for those charges, the government will have to prove whatever part of the charges Manning did not already admit to.
It does seem very unusual. I mean, you don't hear about that very often at all.
No. And in fact, I did not even know about it before this trial. I've educated myself since then.
Yeah, I was trying to be somewhat knowledgeable sounding, but I never heard of it before either.
Yeah, no, it's not. First of all, I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I have to say that up front. But also, I think it's not a very common. Not a common beast.
So what remains that, in other words, what is this trial that's going on now? What charges specifically is he being tried for at the moment?
Right. Well, he did not plead to a charge of aiding the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the sort of big ticket charge, really, in some ways that the government has brought against him. And he pled guilty to some of the Espionage Act charges, but not others. But for every charge that he did plead guilty to, he struck from the statutory language the idea that he did this with reason to believe that it would harm the United States, and so he, or that he did it wrongfully, or you know, any language that sort of characterized what he did as reckless or malicious, he struck.
So
the government still has to prove that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so the remaining charges that are left, or charge, whatever is left, is they still have to prove that part of it. They have to prove that he had a reasonable understanding that this may cause tremendous harm to national security or other people, right?
That's right. They have to prove that. They have to prove the aiding the enemy charge entirely. So they have to prove that he knowingly gave intelligence to the enemy, indirectly in this case. And there are a handful of other charges to which he did not plead guilty that they will have to prove in their entirety. But those are the major things.
So what would be the if he was found guilty on what's remaining that he's being tried for, what is the parameters of sentencing that he's subject to?
Life in prison. I mean, he is subject to the death penalty under the aiding the enemy charge, but the government has already said that it will not pursue the death penalty. And if it were planning to pursue the death penalty, that would have some. It cannot change its mind on that.
Because really?
It would have,
So this has happened. I don't know. I mean, with the Rosenbergs, I can't think of anybody else has been. Is there anybody else been executed for this?
For leaking information?
For actually spying, for taking information that was secret government information.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, obviously, what has to be proved is that he passed it on willingly and knowing that there would be damage. But the Rosenbergs were tried and found guilty and executed for knowingly, spying on the United States, passing it to our enemies, and thus causing, various justices have phrases, serious evil, clear and present danger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Right. I mean, I think it's a little dangerous to make comparisons to cases in which the defendants were accused of spying. I mean, what's notable about this case is that he was not accused of spying. The aiding the enemy charge. That he indirectly gave information to the enemy, but not that he was attempting to help them, just that he knew he was giving it to them, which is it's different. So
yeah, that is
he and in the past, you know, the sentences that we have seen when people have in fact leaked information to the media, which is what he did, and have been prosecuted for that. Under the Espionage Act, which this has been very, very rare in our history, but it has happened a few times. There's only one conviction that has happened, and then there are a bunch of plea deals. And in all cases, we're talking about very, very light sentences.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really unprecedented, the idea that somebody, through leaking information to the media, might go to jail for the rest of his life. And this is really a whole new ballgame.
Ellsberg was accused under the Espionage Act, right?
He was charged under the Espionage Act, and his case was dismissed basically because of prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, yeah, they broke into his psychiatrist's office. I guess that was...
Right, that's one way to put it.
That would qualify for misconduct.
Yes.
So the military court that he's being tried in, are we dealing with any sort of very different rules of evidence and procedure in a military court compared to a federal court?
I know about some of the differences. I don't know about all of them. I have to be sure. Full disclosure. I'm not an expert in military criminal procedure, so some of this is new to me. I mean, what's striking to me is how much of the proceedings is being allowed to take place in secret. I don't think you would see that in a regular criminal court. And in a regular criminal court, there's something called the Classified Information Procedures Act, which governs how classified information is handled, and it does sometimes result in some closed proceedings. But for the most part, there's a system by which the government can submit redacted information or summaries of classified information to allow the trial to go forward as publicly as possible. And the judge in this case has more or less rejected those options and has agreed to close off a pretty big chunk of the trial to the public. And to me, she is operating under the military rules of evidence, which allow her to do that. I can't speak to whether it's a difference in the rules themselves or just a difference in sort of the culture of how those rules are implemented. There are others who could speak to that, but it's certainly a different result.
I wonder if there's an assumption that when there's a military trial like this, aside from the fact that he swore that oath that everybody who joins the military swears, you know, I mean, like, for instance, me personally, I don't know if you did, but I never did swear an oath to defend, you know, against enemies, foreign and domestic, that kind of thing. But he took that oath. And also, he's a serving member of the armed forces. But it seems to me one of the larger assumptions is for secrecy or more, let's say, restricted rights that you would have as a person should occur maybe perhaps in wartime. And that's already been debated and discussed at the highest levels already. But it seems to me that there's the secrecy involved here. There's probably little justification, in my opinion, for it. In other words, and of course, naturally, this happens in all these cases, the American public would believe in their system a lot more, or their system of justice, no matter where it took place, if it was more open.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, they say the cover-up is always worse than the crime, right? I think in some ways, trying to keep all this secret causes a different kind of harm, but ultimately perhaps more harm than making a real good faith effort to be as transparent as possible. You know, I don't know how much of the secrecy is based on the fact that some of these documents that are readily publicly available are technically still classified. I don't know if
That's silly. I mean, the whole world has read them already.
Right, and I don't know how much of it is based on that. I mean, I certainly hope. I certainly hope that's not the issue. You can see that in some cases, if the government's being required to prove how the disclosure could cause harm, that the government doesn't want to take the stand and explain to the enemy how they might use this information to cause harm. So you can see why in some situations we would need to be very careful. But as I've said, in the civilian courts, which handle a lot of very sensitive cases involving all kinds of criminal and terrorist activity, the courts have found a way to handle the classified information in a way that preserves maximum openness and while simultaneously preserving national security.
Yeah, I think generally they have, although there are some places in the country in certain trials in the last several years, terrorism trials, where evidence was asked for by the defense lawyers. And it wasn't given to them, and the judge seems to always rule in the favor of the government in those cases.
Well, you know, it is true that the civilian courts are also becoming more secretive, that we're seeing more redacted opinions. So I don't want to sound too rosy about that, but as I said before, I think there's still a big difference between how this trial is being conducted and how trials in the civilian system are conducted.
Let me ask you about this. I think maybe this has already been dealt with by the court in this case, but you can refresh my memory possibly. The way he was treated when he was being held before he went to trial, does that have any bearing or any effect on the trial itself or his ultimate sentence?
It does have an effect on his sentence, and the judge has already ruled that his ultimate sentence, whatever it may be, will be docked 112 days.
112 days. Oh, so for every day that she decided that he was being treated harshly or in a way which was not comporting with whatever, that's what he gets credit for that?
That's seemingly.
Mm-hmm. As a principle, that doesn't seem to go, as a precedent, that doesn't strike a whole serious note with me. You know what I mean?
No, me either. I mean, that doesn't seem.
Well,
the remedy doesn't seem to fit the wrong in this situation.
I was surprised that I don't know how much legal mileage somebody could get out of this, but when they asked Obama during the time when he was being treated the most harshly, and there were details about how he was being treated, some people claimed it was torture. If it wasn't, it was pretty close to it in some cases.
Well, right, and the UN rapporteur for torture,
right.
Special rapporteur, basically said that this was cruel and inhuman, and depending on its effect on him, may even have risen to the level of torture.
Yeah, so then somebody asked the commander-in-chief, who's in charge of this whole trial, ultimately, at least by title, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Mr. Obama. You've heard, recent details have been revealed to the public about the way he was treated. What do you think of that? And Mr. Obama said, and I'm paraphrasing pretty closely here, I think it was appropriate the way he was treated. I thought they should have just thrown the whole thing out after that. I mean, talk about a prejudiced case.
Yeah.
If that was a jury, I would have said the jury has been prejudiced by the president of the United States into assuming that he's so bad that he was treated this way. You see what I'm saying?
Not only that, but the president also said that he broke the law. I mean, at one point he said he broke the law in those words, and that was an issue in the pretrial proceedings, is whether there was sort of undue command influence, because he's the commander in chief. He is at the top of the chain of the people who are deciding, the person now who is deciding this case.
Mm-hmm.
And her boss just said he's guilty. So that's.
Well, I mean, if Judge Lind mm-hmm. wants to go from Colonel to General Lind, who knows? You go along to get along. I don't know. Or get along.
Well, I don't want to impugn her integrity. I think, there's a reason why it's inappropriate to make statements like that, and it's because it certainly undermines the appearance of impartiality, even if not the reality. Because I'm not in a position to say that she will that this particular judge is going to be influenced by that.
There's a couple of questions. If you just tuned in, we're listening to Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Brennan Center for Justice, their center's Liberty and National Security Program. I just got through this morning reading this new book by Floyd Abrams called Friend of the Court. And it's all about, obviously, Mr. Abrams, probably maybe the most renowned living attorney about First Amendment issues, right? And leaks and journalism.
Absolutely.
And so he was comparing... first of all, there was one issue before I go into that. But you've spent time studying. You've talked about overclassification of documents, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So does that have any bearing at all on this case, or is that just something that's sort of a larger discussion that is associated with this case?
No, well, I think it does. It does have a bearing in a couple of ways. I mean, one way, which is more of a sort of background point, it has to do with the likelihood that a leak is going to happen in the first place. I mean, there's so much information that's classified that should not be classified that it really is impossible for people in Bradley Manning's position who see all of this to take it seriously, right? I mean, he knows that most of what he sees that is classified could easily be released. So I think that just makes people in his position more willing to leak information in good faith, or more able to leak information in good faith, because he rather than having reason to believe that it will harm national security, he actually has reason to believe that it probably won't. And mm-hmm. so, that's the problem with that is that sometimes that's not true. I mean, sometimes things are properly classified. And
right.
so, there were things that Bradley Manning released that I think should not have been released. I think anyone would agree should not have been released.
Mm-hmm.
So overclassification has that sort of effect on our security by undermining respect for the system. More directly, in this case, the government's going to have to prove that Manning had reason to believe that these disclosures would harm national security. And I'm very interested to see how much reliance the government and the judge place on the fact that the documents were classified, because I just think that based on the existence of overclassification,
mm-hmm.
really should have very little significance. Bradley Manning's lawyer wanted to introduce some witnesses to testify about overclassification. Mm-hmm. The judge refused to have those witnesses testify, but she did say that she would take judicial notice, which mm-hmm. means that she'll consider it. She'll consider the issue of overclassification. Basically, she was saying, everybody knows there's overclassification, and I will consider that fact for what it's worth, but you don't need to put on testimony.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have pushed that. I mean, obviously, his lawyer has to do everything he can. I mean, you know, he'll use a shotgun with, like, 1,000 pellets in it, and maybe one or two of them will hit the target, you know. So, but basically, it's like claiming, you know, there's so many watches around all over the place that it's easier to steal them. It's not such a big deal. You know what I mean? It's not. I mean, I wouldn't push an argument.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it very much depends on the government strategy. If the government tries to make a very big deal out of the fact that these documents were classified, then maybe he'll have the chance to put on a rebuttal witness, or at least in rebuttal to bring up the issue of overclassification to say, no, actually, it's not necessarily so significant that this document was marked secret.
But you know, and then here's the next issue, which is seems to be the perfect segue for it. There's been a lot of people, including the newspapers who published some of these documents originally, denounced the way in which Bradley Manning released something like, I don't know what it is, and the numbers keep changing, 300,000 roughly secret documents. A lot of them have to do with the State Department, nothing to do with the conduct of the war in Iraq, right? So there's been many comparisons, and I just got through reading Mr. Abrams' comparisons in his book, Floyd Abrams, where he says WikiLeaks is not the Pentagon Papers. And many people have pointed this out, including a listener of mine, very intelligent, sort of well-informed guy, whose son and daughter work for the State Department at relatively high levels in places like Saudi Arabia and other places. And anyhow, between that and what Abrams listed and what other people have listed as the harm that was done by this scattershot, ill-considered, and maybe what he calls irresponsible release of documents is different than what Ellsberg did, where he deliberately released certain things and actually withheld other documents on purpose because he had read every one of them. Actually, he wrote that history partially, and he was one of the few people who read the whole thing before it was released. In other words, between the journalists and between the leakers, to use a certain word, there was a lot more responsibility, people are claiming, in like a sandwich in Ellsberg's case and maybe even in Mr. Snowden's case, where he says he knows a whole lot and other people say he probably knows a whole lot more, but he chose not to do it. So in other words, there's where Manning is in this place in the middle where he's being claimed to be by people who would back him as irresponsible.
Right. I mean, that's me. I mean,
and that's me, too, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I've said that I think he was irresponsible, not so much because these were State Department documents versus, you know, war records. You know, so I don't think that's really a distinction that's so important to me. But just because, you know, he couldn't have read all of the documents.
Right.
He just couldn't have read them all. So he took a real risk. You know, as I said, most classified documents could probably be safely released. That's not my judgment. That's the judgment of, you know, officials from both parties from across the political spectrum who have come forward and said most, anywhere from 50 to 90% of classified documents should not be classified.
Well, even the people after that, they interviewed a lot of people at the highest levels of the Defense Department, like a year or two or three or 4 years after the Ellsberg situation, and they said most of this stuff didn't do any harm and wouldn't have done any
harm. Yeah. Exactly. But that being said, there are documents that are properly classified. They're classified for a good reason. So for me to take a bunch of documents, you know, 750,000 documents, most of which you have not read, and just do a data dump, that is highly, highly irresponsible. But this is where, I mean, things don't always have to be entirely black and white. And, you know, under the law or elsewhere, or in terms of how, you know, we as a public perceive these actions, you know, there's a spectrum of different kinds of national security leaks. And it ranges from Aldrich Ames and from spies and people who are really trying to harm the United States to whistleblowers with the best of intentions who are very careful about what they release and who are, you know, revealing clear government misconduct. And then, you know, there's everything in between that. So, yes, I think Bradley Manning falls somewhere in the middle of the spectrum.
Does that make it harder to would you have a harder time defending him? You know, in court?
I would not have a harder time defending him against Espionage Act charges because there are administrative and criminal penalties out there that are much better suited to the crime and that don't involve these kinds of incredibly harsh sentences. You know, they don't involve manipulating a law that was designed for spies. I mean, it's called the Espionage Act.
Right.
You know, so there's a more fitting way to go about imposing some kind of punishment. But I do think some kind of punishment makes sense in Bradley Manning's case. You know, as for Snowden, I think it's far too early to say because we don't know. We've been told that other leaks might be coming, and we don't know at this point, first of all, what some of the national security consequences might be from what's been revealed already, although it does not seem at this point that there's evidence of how harm could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly don't know what's going to happen in the future. So, I'm reserving judgment on him.
No, that makes sense. So maybe we could move off to this thing, our whole idea of this. Is it all right if we talk a little bit about the NSA situation without, Snowden himself? A warrant was signed by one of the FISA court judges, and I think there are 9 of them, right?
And it's an order. Is it technically not a warrant?
It was an order. Order to, an order. And basically it allowed the FBI or NSA to go to these organizations and demand that they produce phone logs or perhaps even, although it's been denied, email records and other, or even email. So we don't really know that yet. But the structure of this interests me and worries me. Unless I got this wrong, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Mr. Roberts in this case, could be anybody, whoever it was, gets to appoint these judges. Is that correct?
That is true. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of concentrated power of a certain sort, which could be extraordinary in one person's hands. You would have to assume that he's almost like a saint or perfectly fair or just, right?
No, I don't think you have to say that because, it's not that he gets to appoint people he happens to know or people mm-hmm. he thinks would be good judges. He's appointing federal judges who have already gone through the process of being nominated and confirmed. So these are not, these are people who have already been deemed to be, impartial and professional enough to serve on the bench. So it doesn't concern me so much for that reason. It concerns mm-hmm. me a lot more that this whole idea that you have a court that operates completely outside the adversarial system, the system where one party presents one side of the issue and the other party presents the other side of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
This system, we have it in this country for a very good reason, and it's not because we like to give an unfair advantage to defendants in criminal cases or anything.
Right.
We do it because this is the best way that any legal system has come up with to get to the truth, to get to the right answer.
Right.
And when you have only one party putting on the evidence, it is just not surprising when the judge agrees with that party. So, that's what's very problematic about the FISA court.
Apparently, there have been roughly 39,000 requests to the FISA court since they were set up, and they rejected 9 of them. So
11.
Is it 11?
11. They were
okay.
rejected. I know. 11. So really.
Yeah,
it's
no,
fine.
Really. That's something, But I guess we have. Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to caveat that a little bit because they've rejected 11, but they have modified a lot of these orders. So they make changes from what it is the government wants. Whether those modifications are significant or not, we have no way of knowing.
So it's really the fact that that the whole process and everything about it is so hidden. First of all, it just isn't really it really isn't the way that we should run our legal system. And B, again, I always keep stressing this, the appearance of what's fair is very much as important in a democracy as what is actually being done.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the absolute opposite of what seems to be open and fair.
Right. I mean, the very notion of a secret court is, as you say, it's not just a matter of what kinds of decisions come out of it. It's a matter of just a sense and a perception that this is not consistent with our democratic values.
Before we had these, why do we have FISA courts? I mean, before the FISA courts, how did people go about, how did the government go about doing things like this that was different?
That's the thing. Before the FISA court, it just did it. It didn't get anybody's permission. I mean, the reason that FISA exists and the FISA court exists is because the church committee revealed that the government was pretty much willy-nilly vacuuming up whatever information it wanted. So at the time it was passed, FISA and the FISA court were a real advance in terms of protections for Americans' rights. What has happened since then, first of all, I would argue that the idea of a court that operates entirely in secret was ill-conceived, even if it was an advance at the time. But beyond that, the actual statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, has been entirely revamped and completely weakened to the point that the government no longer needs any individual court order in order to wiretap an American's international communications. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is a sea change in the statute that completely undermines its legitimacy.
Do you think it's time to for Congress, God help us all, to completely revamp this structure, or to refresh it or renew it, like, you know, break it down, take a good look at it and restructure it so that our freedoms and our ability to have a democracy is sort of like brought back to a point where it belongs?
The real Congress or the one they talk about in the Constitution?
Either one. Go ahead. Tell me.
I mean, Do I think that FISA should be amended to make some very important changes? Yes, I do. Would I like to see Congress take that on right now?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see some narrow fixes to some of the problems that have come out from the stories that we've seen recently. I'm worried about what would happen if Congress really rewrote FISA today from scratch. I don't think I would like what came out of it.
Okay, I think I understand what... what you're saying. So last question is, and I won't keep you forever. You're busy, obviously. So now we switch to, and Mr. Abrams wrote a lot about this in his book because he defended the New York Times during the time of the Pentagon Papers. He's defended newspapers, television stations, other places over and over again in his career. And he often quotes Justice Brennan, which I thought was interesting. In fact, even one of the articles in his book is merely a reprint of a speech he gave at the Brennan Center after he had fought for Citizens United. So he's not shy about walking into the lion's den, you know. So,
but it
must have been strange to be working at the Brennan Center if you were there when he did this. But I don't know how far back.
Yeah.
But it's strange to talk to someone from the Brennan Center when he so clearly quotes, and you know. So anybody who's interested in freedom of speech has got to wind up with Mr. Brennan eventually, right? So you know. Here's the thing. So let's move on to the journalists, right? In this case, Mr. Abrams, would never even classify Julian Assange as a journalist, but he's willing to give him the benefit of the doubt for First Amendment purposes. But then he condemns him for saying also that he seems to have one single political philosophy: is there should be no secrets anywhere for anybody, and that's why he and also did not read all this stuff and just leaked it all. He doesn't see him the same way as the New York Times, who spent something like 3 months, 10 reporters or something, 3 months in a hotel room reading every single word before stuff was printed, you know. And now we have Greenwald, to just finish out the thought. You know, Glenn Greenwald, who, you know, one of the more, you know, rash sort of off the deep end members of Congress wants to prosecute for, I think, espionage or whatever it was, you know. So what is the position of somebody like Assange or the journalists in this case? I mean, they deserve a lot of protection, right?
Sure, they do. I mean, I think anybody, the press has the same First Amendment protections as anybody, essentially. It's not, they don't get more protections and they don't get less protections. Government employees give up some of their First Amendment rights, and that, you know, in return for their government service, they have to sign away some of their First Amendment rights. And that's, you know, that's understood, that's been established. Mm-hmm. You know, people who go into the military sign away some of their First Amendment rights. So there's no doubt that legally speaking, Bradley Manning and, you know, Edward Snowden are in a different category from the New York Times and Julian Assange. But the New York Times and Julian Assange are in the same category. That doesn't mean that I, you know, don't hope that journalists or or whoever comes into possession of this kind of information and wants to publish it, I do hope that those people exercise caution and care, and they, you know, I think, you know, that you want them to be able to go to the government and say, look, I want to publish this. Tell me what you think is going to happen and have that conversation. I think, you know, by the government cracking down on reporters, as it seems to be doing now, that really does not encourage that kind of discussion beforehand. But anyway, I want people to be responsible. I want them to do what the New York Times did. But that doesn't mean, you know, the First Amendment doesn't just protect responsible speech.
True. True. Or else where would talk radio be?
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyhow, so yeah, I mean, really, we can go through a million cases, but somebody who's just saying something completely offensive, vulgar, or outrageous, it's the oldest story in the world. You have to defend their right to say it, because then it comes around to you, who you might consider to be your own self, extremely responsible or, you know, not vulgar, but you have to extend the same protections, or else you've had it, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and there are lines that we should not be crossing, and one of those lines is I don't think any kind of journalist or any person who publishes information that they have received from a government leaker should be prosecuted. As I said, I feel differently about the leakers themselves.
When I looked at a copy of Mr. Vinson's order, you know, the Judge Vinson down in Florida, who they had a copy of his order, which said, nobody is allowed to look at this or you'll burst into flames or you'll be arrested or whatever it said in there, you know, I mean, legal language. You know, so I looked at the thing and I'm thinking, am I now guilty of having looked at a top secret document against the law?
I don't think so.
And so what makes it, you know what I'm saying, though? But that's a top secret.
The court order binds, you know, the person that is. This was an order to Verizon, and it was basically, I think, binding Verizon. I don't think the order binds you in any way.
So it's not binding Glenn Greenwald either, right?
No, it's not. It's not binding Glenn Greenwald. No, I mean, if the government wanted to prosecute Glenn Greenwald, I don't think they do. I don't think they will. But if they did, it would not be on the basis that he, you know, disobeyed what the order said. Mm-hmm. It would be, you know, on this Espionage Act.
He received information which he very. I mean, Glenn Greenwald is a pretty smart guy. He's a lawyer. He received information that he knew. I'm not going to use the word damage because that's a fraught word, but he received information that he knew was top secret information, right? He received it and he printed it or had the Guardian print it. So is he in no well? Like, for instance, here's another case. What's his name that they sent to jail? The aide to Cheney, you know, for
refusal.
The one who was cited for contempt because he wouldn't cooperate, you know, when the Valerie Plame affair. And he was sent to jail. Cheney's right-hand man, his assistant, his chief aide. Yeah, right. So he was.
Yeah, okay. Libby.
Libby. Oh, he's sent to jail. But I always wondered, he gets sent to jail, but the person who printed that, of course, is granted, I forget who's the newspaper.
Cohen.
Yeah. So he gets away with that, right?
Well, not only that, but ultimately the person who leaked that was Richard Armitage, right? He eventually admitted that he was the person who leaked it, and he hasn't been charged under anything. And that's why in the case of John Kiriakou, who's the CIA person who disclosed waterboarding, at some point, I think a Department of Justice spokesperson or somebody said, well, you know, we are not prosecuting him because he talked about waterboarding. We're prosecuting him because he revealed the name of a covert CIA agent. And if you cannot reveal the name of the CIA of a covert CIA agent, we must prosecute you if you do that. Mm-hmm. Well, here's Richard Armitage going about his business. So, you know.
Well, when it comes to unprosecuted people, but it is alarming. I guess the final thing here is, before I go on and make some comments myself, the what's alarming is that, forget about political expectations or what party somebody's in, it's alarming to see the executive, in this case represented by Mr. Obama, pursuing a course even more passionately or ardently against freedom, it seems to me, freedom of information and freedom of reporters to do their job and whistleblowers, more even than his predecessor, who everybody was alarmed about in the first place. That is an alarming trend, right?
Yeah. It is alarming. It's unexpected. It's surprising. I think, you know, in the beginning, there was certainly a hope and a promise from President Obama that he was going to be more transparent and, in fact, the most transparent administration in history. Mm-hmm. We figured out pretty quickly that on national security issues, he was going to be largely the same. Mm-hmm. But then, as it turns out, he on this one issue, he's actually worse, and I don't think anyone expected that. Now, I have to say, he is better on one issue of national security secrecy, and that is classification. He has actually been trying to work on the problem of overclassification. I have to give him his due on that. Mm-hmm. It's been disappointing, but yeah.
Well, I think he is transparent. You could look at him. This is my point of view. It's nothing to do with my guest. I think he's transparent. You look at him, and you can look right through him and see the NSA and the CIA.
Yeah.
So he's transparent as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't have any trouble with his transparency.
That's new. I hadn't heard that one before.
Well, I just thought of it, so it's better be new. So maybe I'll get in trouble for that. But all right, listen, thanks for coming on. I mean, there's all these issues. And obviously, as you say, there's a lot to come. You know, stay tuned for Mr. Snowden and what's left. I'm also interested in side issues, which are like, you know, the extradition, you know, from Hong Kong. But that's a whole separate issue. I mean, obviously, he's picked a place which has an interesting history as far as extradition goes. So he knew what he was doing, right?
Yep.
So basically, here we are with the First Amendment and with Bradley Manning. This trial will go on for many months, probably at least, right?
Well, they said through the beginning of August. But probably longer in my view.
If he wanted to appeal, if he got sentenced to some pretty harsh thing, can he appeal? What's the appeals process there?
Yeah, sure. There's a military court of appeals. The military justice system has, you know, the sort of analogous version to the civilian criminal court system.
Could he be pardoned by the president?
I think so. I don't think there's anything in the pardon clause that would prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
I somehow don't think that's going to happen.
No, I'm guessing not. Probably not. Yeah. I'm just asking. It's interesting to me. So, all right. Listen, thanks so much for taking the time to come on. Elizabeth Goitein, who is one of the co-directors of the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. If you don't know about the Brennan Center, go to their website. It's BRENNAN, named after Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, a champion of free speech and various other things. And go to this website. It is really a fascinating place, and it addresses all sorts of issues about voting law and everything else, immigration, everything you could think of in this country. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much.
Okay. We are going to can we take a short break? What are you going to play, a happy birthday, or what are we going to play here? All right. Okay, we're back. This is Mike Fader on Occupied Territory America. Don't forget our Facebook page, where there's plenty of stuff posted there on Bradley Manning and Snowden and the NSA. It's interesting to me on a personal level. See, my guest, who is a lawyer who works for a very well-known place that represents cases all the way up to the Supreme Court, and a lot of these people have clerked for Supreme Court justices. This is a serious place. She can't make certain statements of opinion. I mean, she's not into speculating, you know, on behalf of the Brennan Center. And, you know, like a lot of people whose hearts are in the right place legally or as far as justice goes, she's not going to make certain statements, would tend to prejudice things in advance. But I can. I'm not a lawyer. I only play one on the radio. So here's the situation. You've got Bradley Manning. There's a lot of people who I have tremendous respect for. And even the newspapers themselves, like the Post, Washington Post, one of the Berlin newspaper, the New York Times and other newspapers, when they finally saw what was done and when they saw what was leaked, they only chose a small portion of these things to reveal, and they rejected a lot of the other things. And their own editorial pages condemned the scattershot, process that by Bradley Manning uses, just leaking everything. He didn't read all this stuff. He leaked everything. And there are people, and as I say, people who I respect a lot, certain journalists and writers and scholars and lawyers, and one of my listeners, whose kids, grown children, are who work for the State Department. He was saying, for instance, that one of them worked for a while, was posted in Saudi Arabia, and they were talking about human trafficking, about, you know, slave trafficking, human trafficking, which goes on in various parts of the world and is a pernicious, vicious, horrible thing, right? Well, a lot of people apparently in the State Department, in back channels, in countries where, there is no sense of justice and no respect for women whatsoever, like Saudi Arabia, our brave ally, right? But that's another story. These people were put in jeopardy, and their programs to stop these things. And here's a list of things, according to my correspondent, who wrote in about this. And this was reported to him by his children. He says, here's a list of things that people in the State Department, and this is just his son and daughter-in-law, worked on, and presumably a lot of people, other people in the State Department all over the world. Whatever you think about the State Department and its relationship to the military and what they're doing behind the scenes, too, they may actually be doing some good in the world. For instance, they were working on stopping human trafficking. They were working on reclaiming highly enriched uranium given to countries during the Eisenhower administration for experimentation. They're working on initiatives on maternal health in the Mideast, helping U.S. citizen who was deported illegally by ICE, and opening up a border crossing at Big Bend Park in Texas, environmental initiatives with the Mexican government, working with NGOs to help refugees around the world. In other words, the State Department works on a lot of these issues, and they have to work with back channels. And more importantly, they have to work with a lot of informants and people who are willing to come forward and be extremely courageous in dictatorial, brutal, either religious or otherwise, harsh dictatorships where there is no law, no justice. You can be shot down, disappeared, and that's the end of you. A lot of people bravely come forward to give information to the people in the State Department so that some of these programs could possibly be advanced or some wedge could be made into these countries to make them a better place to live. Manning released documents that put a lot of these people in jeopardy, and there's a whole other long list of things that he did. And because the bulk of the documents that Bradley Manning released were State Department documents, back-channel documents. A couple of ambassadors got asked to leave. Their positions were terminated by various governments because they said things off the record in cables, which they should know better than to do. These days, right, after the NSA and Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and especially what we're reading now, you have to be crazy to even imagine for a second that everything you say and do. And of course, I'm on the radio, so it doesn't make any difference. I've been outed for 35 years, so it doesn't make any difference. But every phone call you make on your landline, on your cell phone, everything you do that has anything electronic connected to it, they know about. They may know about it while you're doing it. I read something just this morning, an article that said that the NSA is capable of, and who knows where this goes, right? This is a whole other, let's mix up some metaphors, kettle of worms, right? Who knows where this goes? The NSA, as you're typing an email or as you're entering data on your computer, they can see it as you're typing it if they want to. Imagine what that means. Now, one thing is, obviously, this kind of abuse. So, wait a minute. Let me finish with Bradley Manning. Okay? I'm interrupting myself. Manning did this, and compared to what Ellsberg did, once again, let me restate what Daniel Ellsberg did. This guy was a Marine who served in Vietnam. While he was serving Vietnam, I think he served two tours over there. And he saw with his own eyes a very, very intelligent, sort of a man with some experience already and very intelligent, very educated. He saw that this was a moral, political, strategic, and every other way, a travesty that's beyond reclamation, right? He said it was just wrong. He comes back to work for the Defense Department, later he worked for the RAND Corporation. And he went to his superiors in the Defense Department and said, this is a bad war. We shouldn't be here, and this is wrong. And then he went to, later on, he even testified in front of a couple of congressional committees about how everything over there was wrong. Not only that it was wrong, but everything we did to go in there and everything we did, that I said we, I mean our government. We always have to make a distinction between the government and us, because, in fact, the government has made that distinction now. There is no United States government. There is the government, which is like a separate country that owns and runs everything. And then there's the rest of us, basically otherwise known as voters, citizens, and saps, or sheep, right? So he goes and he went through the proper channels. In other words, he said, no, this is wrong. And he tells somebody else, that's wrong. He goes to his superiors. He goes to Congress. So what happened was that Robert McNamara, way after the horses had left the barn, commissions a giant study about how we got into this politically and militarily in the first place. And the entire study should also include everything up until the very minute that we were at war in Vietnam. It was like 1967 or something like that. And so there turned out to be something like 40 volumes of details and classified material and history. And essentially, it made it very clear that almost everything we did to get in there, including lying about the Gulf of Tonkin, about lying about being attacked. In other words, American troops and soldiers and military advisors were in Vietnam for a long time, provoking and trying to overthrow people, assassinating people. There were murder squads in there. So talk about provocation. We started it, believe me. First the French started it, then we took over. As bad as it can get. CIA operatives, special forces troops, everything. So finally, there may have been, but probably not, now that we read back on it, an unprovoked, quote-unquote, attack by a couple of, North Vietnamese gunboats on an American ship in the Gulf of Tonkin. So Johnson uses this as an excuse. It's like, 9/11 is an excuse. It's like other things that have always been an excuse to go to war, and not even a declaration of war. This was not a declared war in Vietnam. Johnson asked, and this is the creeping executive power, the imperial power, which is actually one of the most destructive, if not the most destructive force against democracy in this country. He said, just give me the power to deal with this. I'll handle it. Didn't ask for a formal declaration of war because he didn't have the goddamn evidence. Basically, we were the ones who declared war on them officially, or I should say unofficially. And they were provoked, and they were trying to defend their own country and their own liberty. So Ellsberg gets commissioned, along with a few other people, to write a whole – he was writing this whole history. So he knew it was wrong. He's writing this whole history. Finally, he's in the RAND Corporation, and he sees that this is not going to stop. He tries everything to get it to stop. He thought even by writing this history that the government itself, Kennedy, McNamara, all these people would see how wrong it was and all the lies that are constantly being told and what the horrors that we perpetrated over there were being covered up. Everything about lying, how to get into it, sound familiar? Iraq, just lying to get into the war, doing things that are covered up. So he says, this is no good. They're not listening to me. It's wrong. People are being murdered in the hundreds, even thousands, every week over there. I'm going to stop this as much as I can. 1971, he brings these papers to the New York Times. A lot of people, including a lot of Defense Department people and military historians, have said that because he did that, although it was near the end of our involvement, really large, massive involvement, that it saved thousands and thousands and thousands of lives by doing that, people fighting in a war where they didn't belong in the first place. If only people had done this kind of thing or had come forward right around the time of Iraq. Now, people were doing this, one of whom was Valerie Plame's husband, and he was smeared and libeled by the government for doing this. He was dismissed from his, he was demoted, dismissed from his job practically. He was smeared and libeled, Wilson. And she was outed, which is actually a crime for which Cheney should have gone to jail. I mean, Cheney and Bush and Powell and Rice at least those four people, probably Rumsfeld too, all those people should be serving the rest of their lives in prison. They are criminals of the highest order. They are mass murderers and criminals. When Obama got into office, of course, this is all part of the delusion and the illusion of Barack Obama that a lot of people felt, you know, that, you know, and the lesser of two evils, right? The first thing he did when he got into office, aside from appointing the people who crashed Wall Street to the highest positions in the government, secretary, you know, of the Treasury and, you know, head of the, whoever it was, he appoints all the people who crashed the entire economic system to be his economic agencies, heads and advisors. The other thing, but the one thing he should have done right after he, you know, shouldn't have done that, one thing he should have done was he should have had the Justice Department investigate and indict George Bush and Dick Cheney and Powell and Rice and several other people for deliberately lying and selling a lie to the American people so that we would invade Iraq. And look where all that has gotten us now. One of the reasons why the whole country is completely obliterated, broke, why any moral fiber in this country practically doesn't exist anymore, why there are tens of thousands between Iraq and our continued involvement in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of Americans who are permanently crippled in their minds and bodies, why there are several hundred thousand people dead in Afghanistan and especially in Iraq from American involvement, while the country's culture and politics and everything else is totally destroyed, while there are a million refugees. Even during the bombing starting in Clinton's era, hundreds of thousands of children sickened and died because of what we did over there. Anytime somebody wants to leak this, it's okay with me. All I'm asking is, like a lot of other people, and I respect these people, that you pay attention to what you're doing. Yeah, leak it all, but first tell me that there's a reason to do it. In Bradley Manning's case, I'm on his side. I would defend him. If I was the judge, I might sentence him to something, and then I would let him off or give him probation or give him a really small sentence. But there's a difference between what Snowden did, what Ellsberg did, and what Manning did. Still, all of them, as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't call them, go so far as to call Manning a hero. Maybe the other two I would. So it's a complicated issue and something we should all pay a lot of attention to. All right. Thanks for tuning in. This is Occupied Territory America. We'll be back next Thursday. Try our Facebook page, Occupied Territory. Okay.
Took the hand.